All right, Wrestling with Theology fans, this is Pastor Doug Minton, and we are standing in the confessional corner, once again, looking at the history surrounding the Reformation. This week, we leave the continent of Europe, well, the main continent at least. And when we leave the continent, we find that the Reformation is also taking place across the channel in England. However, it's not a theological issue in England that starts it as it was in Germany or in Switzerland. The English Reformation is a series of political power plays. As with many other movements around this time, I can't cover everything that happened in England in 20 minutes. I will simply cover the major players from the royal family, primarily. Well, this all starts off with King Henry VIII. He was born on June 28, 1491, to King Henry VII and Elizabeth of York. He is best known for being the catalyst for the English Reformation due to Pope Clement VII's denial for an annulment of his marriage to Catherine of Aragon. Of course, this was only the first of his six marriages, each of these being done to find a wife who could give him a male heir. That male heir, Edward, came from his third wife, Jane Seymour, who died just 12 days after Edward's birth. One of Henry's greatest coups against Rome was demanding Thomas Cranmer to be appointed as the Archbishop of Canterbury. Even before Cranmer's appointment as Archbishop, Henry got Parliament to pass the Ecclesiastical Appeals Act of 1532, which outlawed appeals to Rome on ecclesiastical matters and declared England to be an independent empire. Even as the supreme head of the Church of England, as the Ecclesiastical Appeals Act named him, Henry remained a traditional Catholic. He allowed Thomas Cromwell and Thomas Cranmer to institute many reforms, including the dissolution of monasteries. However, many of these reforms were being reversed by the time Henry dies in 1547. Now we move on to King Edward VI, who was born on October 12th, 1537, to Henry VIII and Jane Seymour. He became King of England on March 20th, 1547, at the age of 9. His uncle Edward Seymour worked with Cranmer to publish a book of homilies which all clergy were to preach from on Sundays. These Protestant sermons were aimed at the condemnation of many of the superstitious elements that had crept into the church, such as the rosary beads, relics, and holy water. This brought about a wave of iconoclasm a few months after Edward's coronation. So we have Henry starting off things, then Edward coming in to take the crown at the age of 9, but it's his uncle Edward who is really in charge for the bulk of his reign, because he only reigns until 1553. So he has, he's roughly 15 when he dies. So it is Edward Seymour and Thomas Cranmer doing a lot of the English Reformation post-Henry. In 1549, the first edition of the Book of Common Prayer was published. It is here that the practice of a corporate service of confession absolution came into the liturgy. In addition to the liturgical changes, clergy marriage was legalized at the same time. The Book of Common Prayer was edited in 1552, and this came about because the shift in the clergy from mostly Catholic to mostly Protestant. One of the greatest characteristic changes was the elimination of any references to the consecration of the elements or the real presence of Christ's body and blood in the Lord's Supper. Really going from being Catholic and Roman to being reformed, like Calvin. As I said, Edward dies on July 6, 1553, at the age of 15. Many feared that the English Reformation might also be buried with him, as his very staunch Roman Catholic sister, Mary, took the throne. Yep, that Mary, Bloody Mary. She is crowned the Queen of England on October 1st, 1553, at the age of 37. So, very much older than Edward was. Mary began her reign with an emphasis on toleration between Protestants and Catholics. She released several important Catholic bishops from prison and then imprisoned Cranmer, the Archbishop of Canterbury. Although Lord Chancellor Gardiner tried to have Parliament repeal all religious laws passed since 1529, the House of Commons flatly refused to pass his bill, but they were amenable to repealing all of Edward's reforms. So they wouldn't go all the way back to the beginning of the Reformation with Henry, but they would go and undo everything that was done during Edward's reign in the last decade. This includes clerical marriage and the Book of Common Prayer, both being outlawed again. In an attempt to secure England again as a Catholic kingdom, she marries King Philip II of Spain. This made her the daughter-in-law of Holy Roman Emperor Charles V. Very good family to include yourself in if you're looking to regain a kingdom's allegiance to Rome. Historian Eamon Duffy classified Queen Mary's program as creative reconstruction, seeking to find what was positive and palatable to the Pope in Henry's and Edward's reforms. Mary got her cousin, Cardinal Reginald Pole, to replace Cranmer as the Archbishop of Canterbury in 1556. In 1555, though, the medieval heresy laws of England were reinstituted. This hardened Mary's original conciliatory tone towards Protestantism. The persecution of Protestants is what gave Mary the nickname Bloody Mary, as 284 Protestants were burned at the stake for heresy. Mary died on November 17, 1558. Mary had no children, and she had not declared a Roman Catholic to succeed her on the throne. Therefore, her Protestant sister Elizabeth would take the throne. So we have now here going from Roman Catholic under Henry to somewhat Protestant to being a little more Calvinist under Edward, back to Catholic under Mary, now back to Protestant of some variety under Elizabeth. So Elizabeth becomes queen on November 17, 1558 at the age of 25. So kind of splitting the difference between Mary and Edward here. Elizabeth almost immediately began to undo all of Mary's Catholic restorations. The Act of Supremacy in 1558 re-established the Church of England's independence from Rome and named Elizabeth the supreme governor of the Church of England. A new version of the Book of Common Prayer was published as a revision of Edward's 1552 Book of Common Prayer. Elizabeth's reforms made the Church of England more Calvinist in nature. Factions formed in the Church of England regarding how far the Reformation should go, very much like on the continent. Many wanted the Church of England to be more like the Reformed churches of Geneva and Zurich. Now, especially the Puritans who wanted to get rid of everything that even smacks of Roman Catholicism in the Church of England. And yet, on March 24th, 1603, Elizabeth dies without an heir, having never married, so having no heir to the throne, thus ending the Tudor dynasty in England. So now we have this kind of power void as the Tudor dynasty is done. That does not mean that there's not somebody that is related to Henry VIII and all of that that can take the throne. Because that's where King James VI of Scotland comes in. The only son of Mary, Queen of Scots, and Henry Stuart. Mary was the great-granddaughter of King Henry VII and Margaret Tudor. James became King of Scotland at the age of 13 months. He became King of England upon Elizabeth's death at the age of 36. During James's reign, another revision of the Book of Common Prayer was published in 1604. This was one of those that was considered kind of the primary authorized versions of the Book of Common Prayer. So if you go back and you look up previous versions, if you are like myself and try to find free copies of books out there, especially the older books, 1604 is going to be one of those that you find as being one of the standout ones, along with the original probably second edition, as well as what comes out later on in what is called the Long Reformation in England. But I'm stopping it here with King James, because it is here where we have the culmination of what Henry and especially Elizabeth wanted to happen, and that is 1611, the authorized version of the Bible, commonly known as the King James Version, is officially published and promoted in the English language. This would be, for almost 400 years, the primary version of the Bible in English. For 300 years of it, almost, the about only English version, until the Revised Version came out in 1881, the American Standard Version in 1901, and then that goes down through the Revised Standard Version of the 1950s, and then what we use here on Wrestling with Theology in the English Standard Version of 2001. Many people, like I said, will go on with wanting to protrude on through English history and through the monarchs, and yes, we could have done biographies of Cranmer and Cromwell and Sir Thomas More and a lot of other people that were involved in all of these things, but my thought was that was going to weigh us down in the weeds, and that's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to get through to King James and the establishment of the authorized version of the Bible in English. But in the midst of all this, in Queen Elizabeth's reign, the biggest thing that happened was the publication of the 39 Articles in 1571 and their adoption by the Church of England as the primary confessional document. The 39 Articles are, 39 Articles of Doctrine and can be divided into 8 sections regarding the doctrine of God in 1 through 5, Scripture in the Creeds in 6 through 8, Sin and Salvation in Articles 9 through 18, the Church and its Authority in 19 through 21, Errors to be Avoided in the Church, very much like anything Roman Catholic, 22 through 24, the Proper Understanding of the Sacraments in their mind in 25 through 31, the Proper Understanding of Church Discipline in 32 through 36, and the Proper Understanding of the Church in Civil Society in Articles 37 through 39. This may be one of those where I go through, as I began to do on Common Ground years ago at the beginning of this podcast, and maybe look through the 39 articles as well as maybe the Heidelberg Catechism again, or the, we did for a while, the Catechism of the Roman Catholic Church. Might be good again to look at these things again as different various studies of what makes Lutherans distinct from these groups. But that's something for another time when I have a little more time on my hands to be able to do something like that. But what we're looking at today with the English Reformation is definitely the understanding of the 80 years between Henry's Ecclesiastical Appeals Act of 1532 and the 1611 publication of the Authorized Version of the Bible were very turbulent years in England. You had, yes, Bloody Mary with the 284 Protestants burned at the stake during her reign. You've got, again, another set of Catholic theologians and people who are tried for heresy and executed during the reigns of Elizabeth and Edward and possibly even James as well. Everything just keeps piling on because it's the idea that came out in the Roman Empire with one of the interims. I believe it was Augsburg, might be Leipzig, but the religion is the rule. That whatever the religion of the king or queen was, that's what became the official religion of the land. And that we see that happen in England. And we see some of the disastrous effects of that, which is one of the reasons why the Founding Fathers sought to eliminate the proclamation of a state religion. But what we have here in America is one of the reasons why we should look at the English Reformation. Because a lot of what we have in American Christianity descends directly from the English Reformation. And whether it's the Puritans, it's the Anglicans, or the Episcopalians here in the U.S., if it's the Presbyterians, as we'll talk about in the next couple of months with John Knox in Scotland, and all these other things that have come around, a lot of it finds its roots in the English Reformation, which is why this makes this study so important. But it is here where we will draw an end to this study. Again, we could go much, much further, and there are many books written on this, and I encourage you, if you would like to read more about the English Reformation, to look at any of those. But until then, this is Pastor Doug Minton, thanking you for standing in the confessional corner with me. Next month, when we continue our history, we're going to go a little bit further north. And having covered the English Reformation, we're going to cover the Scottish Reformation and John Knox. So I encourage you to be back next month for that. Until then, may God's richest blessings be upon you as you wrestle with the theology around you. Amen.